cherish your doubt. Your doubt or your doubts are key to the knowledge, the door of knowledge. This is a foundation of our tradition. In this faith tradition, your doubts and questions will never, ever jeopardize your belonging. In this faith, we uphold the doubts and the questions. They are our process, our ritual, if you will, of being religious. Our doubts frame our journey. Our doubts clarify what we know, what we can rely on, and what we cannot. We who are privileged to be part of this liberal faith have inherited an extraordinary legacy. We have been given the gift of freedom to believe or doubt. The gift of reason to consider that we know of life and compare it to the timeless wisdoms from our history and from other cultures. Now, our ancestors have been sometimes radical doubters. From the Council of Nicaea in 325 of the Common Era, a fellow by the name of Arius doubted how Jesus, if he was a man, could be equal to God. Arius debated at this Council of Nicaea the supposition that Jesus and God were equal. Unfortunately, he lost that debate. And so the Christian church shifted from being an ethical religion to being a creedal religion. What that means is that from that day on, to be a Christian, you simply had to have faith and not question or doubt the teachings of the church. Or to put it another way, Christianity became less concerned with your character, your thoughts, than with the correctness of your belief. The Council of Nicaea began the process that would eventually grow into the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, the doctrine of the Trinity was the teaching that Jesus was fully God and fully man, and that God, while one in nature, was manifest as God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, the Trinity. Arius could be considered our godfather of Unitarianism. Because after Arius, there came a long, long line of our theological ancestors who doubted that God could be divided into three parts and still be considered the unity of all creation. Thus, we became Unitarian, people who believe God was a unity. Now, jump forward to 1920 or the 1920s. And a man by the name of John Dietrich was having doubts about the very existence of God. At the Unitarian National Conference of 1921, he entered into a debate with another Unitarian, William Sullivan, on whether or not God existed at all. This debate went on for a decade and paralleled the same concerns in the popular culture. Dietrich's doubts about God's supernatural powers to create and control the universe eventually led to the Humanist Manifesto in 1933, which attempted to define the universe created by itself through natural evolution and man as part of that natural process. Doubt shifted the basis of our Unitarian theology. Doubt widened our concepts of the relationship and the definitions of man and God, will and power, nature or natural and supernatural. 50 years later, another shift came when women began to have serious doubts about the definition of God as male. They doubted that a male God could really understand women's experience. They questioned where the concept of the masculine description of God came from, and they discovered that in the churches dominated by men, it was, of course, men creating God in their own image. Then they began to inquire into other cultures and into their own history, seeking stories of a time when God was experienced as female. And then they set out to know what had happened to that knowledge, those stories. In the course of this questioning, grown from their initial doubts, They discovered a fuller expression of the divine that included images of both male and female. And thus paganism and earth-based religions and spiritualities became part of our widening, questioning, seeking religious community. The Reverend Christine Robinson writes, "The theology of doubt is the underlying theology of Unitarian Universalism. It is a theology which keeps us from self-righteousness, but not from action. So let us cherish our doubts. They not only lead to larger truth, but they keep us wise, they keep us humble, and allow us to live together in love." This is not a church where you can hide from the world, from the confusions and challenges. This is a church where you are supported to contemplate and then to move forward into action or to return to that question again and again. This is not a church where you can get away from the world. This is a church where we face the challenges and stand together to do what we can to alleviate suffering and confusion and despair. This is a church where we are held together by our common understanding that doubts and questions are a good thing, a very good thing. Tim Keller says, "A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she's failed over the years to listen patiently to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection." I suggest that if we are incapable of doubt, we are incapable of faith. T.S. Eliot, on a fairly down day, said this. He says, "The majority of mankind is lazy-minded, incurious, absorbed in vanities, and tepid in emotion, and is therefore incapable either of much doubt or much faith." I say faith and doubt, they walk hand in hand. We cannot have faith without doubt, nor doubt that does not lead to faith. They are companions on the journey, not enemies, not opposites. More like twins that have grown and born in the same womb at night and have grown together and know each other and are in many ways inseparable. Many Unitarians have emerged out of religious systems that were closed to doubt. Many of you have come from religious communities that told you, "Do not doubt, simply have faith," with that sort of authoritative voice. As if doubt were a killer of faith. As if faith was some magic antidote to the poison, doubt. How wrong that is, at least for me. What suffering it creates in the active inquiring mind to be told that one must not question but have faith. Such a leap between the two, that wide chasm with no bridge, the mind rebels. The alive mind says, even a very young mind says that that's not right, that doesn't feel right, that doesn't sound right, it jars the sense of logic perhaps, affronts the experience of living. In our Unitarian tradition, we foster in our children the ability to ask questions. Unitarians uphold the traditions of education, not because we want the status of university degrees, because many of us just don't have those anyway, but we uphold education because we honor and we respect the gifts of a curious mind. We raise our children to think for themselves, and we ask them more questions than we give answers. We are curious to know what they know. Now, I was not raised a Unitarian, so I didn't benefit from that particular wonderful system of education. So for me, it wasn't until I was in my third year of university that I encountered that opportunity. I met Professor Enyes in my third year. He was from Belgium. a small, trim man, an unassuming man, a gentle man, a great teacher. The university had put him in the sociology department because he really didn't fit in anywhere else, and not even really there. He taught things like the sociology of time and change. He taught entrepreneurs and managers in the business department, therapists in the psychology department, divinity students in the religious studies department. His was a mind that looked outside of the box and saw the connections between the boxes that the people in the boxes couldn't see. It was through his guidance that I began to think. I have wondered from time to time why this particular teacher made such a deep impact on my life. This soft-spoken man who wondered about strange things like time and transformation, and the connections between random points. The kind of thoughts that I had too. Together, one of the things that we studied was the German philosopher, scientist, architect, inventor, Rudolf Steiner. We studied Steiner's theory of human development and the nature of free will, among other things. My mind began to come alive with questions about the beginnings of things, the source of thoughts, the source of existence, the source of will, the source of freedom. We followed Steiner as he explored the question, what is human will? Is it ever really free? How is it free? Can I rely on my free will? And so on. When you question the things that others hold dear or that you yourself hold dear, or that are accepted truths on the nature of reality and our existence, one enters into this exhilarating world of infinite possibilities. And at the same time, one experiences what were once solid foundations, shivering with this new uncertainty, this new doubt. It can be as if an earthquake moves through your mind and all that you had faith in and relied on impossibly shifts. My last memory of Professor Ignace was our final exam. It was a lovely day. I showed up at his office and he invited me to go for a walk with him outside. On this walk, he asked me my thoughts about this and that. At the time, I was nervous and I felt tongue-tied and inadequate. But at the same time, I felt incredibly grateful that he was offering me the kind of education that is so rare in this world. It moves me still, this gentle teaching, his kindness. And today I'm thinking that what he was teaching me was to trust in my own experience, my own thoughts. And that was a lifelong teaching. In fact, the best book that I have ever read on faith was by the Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg, a good Jewish Buddhist. Salzberg's book is called Faith, Believing in Your Own Deepest Experience. And in it she says, quote, the tendency to equate faith with doctrine and then argue about terminology and concepts distracts us from what faith is actually about. In my understanding, she says, whether faith is connected to a deity or not, its essence lies in trusting ourselves to discover the deepest truths on which we can rely. It is an inner quality that unfolds as we learn to trust our own deepest experiences. End of quote. My faith comes in part because I trust my experience of doubt. My faith is resilient because there is a place in it for my doubts. Now, of course, there is such a thing as too much doubt, that debilitating kind of self-doubt, for example, that kind of doubt that breeds such fear that movement forwards and backwards becomes impossible and one just freezes. I've had those experiences as well, when self-doubt grew so large, so overwhelming, that a simple decision to cross the street became almost impossible. And then there's that rigid skepticism or that inflexible doubt. This is when one makes a religion out of negating without ever contributing something positive. Sojourner Truth, the 1800s African-American abolitionist and promoter of women's rights, answers the question, what's the difference between honest doubt and stubborn skepticism? And she says, an honest doubter is thirsty. An answer quenches her thirst. A stubborn skeptic, on the other hand, is an addict. Any amount of intake doesn't seem to satisfy. An honest doubter is confused. A stubborn skeptic has already made up their mind. Perhaps honest doubt is a sign of genuine perplexity, while stubborn skepticism is a sign of an arrogant disbelief. End of quote. An honest doubter is thirsty. An honest doubter is seeking some new possibility. An honest doubter is open to discovery, to new revelation, to a renewed faith. Now, to be sure, as the title of this sermon indicates, I have faith in my doubts and that we as a religious movement uphold our doubts as an essential part of how we practice our faith. And yes, we could say that we are a faith of doubters, but we must not, I put to you, and cannot stop there. Because otherwise we would be those rigid skeptics, addicts. For if doubt is all we have, then I think that we are not doing our job as honest seekers. We do not need to agree that, too, is a tenet of our religious community, but I strongly believe that we must really be seekers of a faith that is supportable. If you only have doubt, then what sustains you and nourishes you? If you only have doubt, then what do you say to the children? If you only have faith in doubt, then what do you rest on when you are scared and overwhelmed? I believe it is our human responsibility to use our minds to question reality, to question our assumptions and our conclusions. Our minds are awesome gifts, to be sure, but our minds are also limited, and we are still children in terms of their use. We must be humble about our minds and its limitations. I think to cling to doubt because you are afraid of faith is a human experience. Human. I think there is a fear of faith. It takes courage to have faith in another person, for example, or an understanding of reality. And can we ever know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if something is true? You know, perhaps not. Does that mean that we shouldn't? I know, and I've said already, that many of you have rebelled against religions that have told you not to question, but have, to not question, but have just faith. And you have recoiled at that ridiculous command because you have a mind and it requires to be used. But is there not a time and a moment when you become aware that the mind has its limitations and that a leap of faith is required for the next step on your journey? I leave you with that question. And in conclusion, I say, when doubt is a testing of belief, cherish your doubts. When doubt is the key to the door of knowledge, then doubt is the servant of discovery. When doubt is the expression of faith in the intelligence and imagination of humanity, it is the expression of humility. It is the expression of wisdom, the expression of courage, the expression of hope. Doubt is good. Cherish your doubts. Have faith in your doubts. And when you see that a leap of faith is necessary, risk leaping.